I am so excited to bring this video to you. I've spent so much work on this. You will see that all of this is all my original thought and ideas, just like every single video is different. This video is called The Great Lakes, The Forgotten Grid, and The Slurry Sediment Deluge. Here we go. This is part one, and this is called The Great Lakes and The Forgotten Grid. I just realized something, and once you see it, you can't unsee it. I've been staring at these old maps from the 1500s, and something is off. In the 1570s, you can already see Chilaga right where Chicago should be. You see cities, castles, settlements, but no Great Lakes. 1570. The inland seas we think have always been there just aren't. It's like they didn't exist yet. Now hold that thought, because here's where it gets wild. Out in Lake Michigan, there's a stone water intake crib. Mainstream says it was built in the late 1800s to bring water into the city. Late 1800s, all right? But think about it. How do you build a massive stone fortress 2 miles offshore, then dig 200 feet down through bedrock under a lake? You don't. The only way it makes sense is if that structure was already there before the water, which means the lake was filled afterward. And it gets stranger. Look at Hoover Dam. Before the reservoir was filled, you see the intake towers rising out of dry rock, same exact blueprint. Build the structures, then flood the basin. So what if Lake Michigan and maybe all the Great Lakes were created the same way? Giant excavations, massive quarries dug out, then deliberately flooded to erase the evidence and repurpose them as reservoirs, capacitors in the planetary grid. The Great Lakes Excavation Tower. I need you to picture this in your mind. A tower standing in the middle of a dry basin. Before there was ever a lake. Not a drilling rig, not a shovel crew, but a resonance machine. An ancient frequency machine, or engine. Ancient frequency engine. This tower doesn't cut stone the way we do with picks or dynamite. It sings to it. It sends out a resonance beam tuned to the natural fracture frequency of the rock below. Just like a wine glass can be shattered with sound, the bedrock itself begins to vibrate, crumble, and lose cohesion. Now here's where it gets wild. Once the rock is destabilized, you don't need dump trucks or carts. You bring in water, rivers are diverted, aquifers are tapped, meltwater channels opened. The resonance field keeps the stone grain suspended and the water mixes into a flowing mud. In an instant, you've turned solid rock into slurry. Inside the tower is a cyclone chamber. The slurry is spun like a vortex, heavy minerals separated from fines. The heavies, the ores, the metals could be harvested. The fines, the silts, and dust are pumped outward, some through flood channels that race across continents, some discharged into rivers that carry the slurry into oceans, and some shot upward. Cavitation plumes blasting rock flour into the sky, where wind spread it around the globe, later raining down as mud layers. That's how you explain the mud flood horizon, not as a random natural event, but as the spoil from planetary excavation distributed through engineered flood pulses and atmospheric injection. Now you might be asking, how do we know this is even possible? Because even today, we have echoes of this exact same technology. Sonic drilling rigs already use high-frequency vibrations to fracture rock instead of cutting it. Ultrasonic cavitation in water is used in medicine and industry. Microscopic bubbles collapsing with enough force to shatter metal and stone. Cyclone separators exist right now in mining. Spinning slurries to separate particles by weight, just like the spiral chamber drawn inside this tower. Hydraulic mining in the 1800s literally washed away mountains with high pressure water, creating instant slurry and massive floods of sediment. And atmospheric injection is nothing new. Modern geoengineering already sprays particulates into the sky to settle later across the earth. And I want to give you an idea. When I'm talking about the size of this thing, I'm saying something like an entire size of a city thing, all right? I mean, I'm talking big. I'm talking big. So you see what's happening here? We still use pieces of this technology. But in the ancient world, it wasn't fragmented like it is today. It was unified. One tower, one system capable of excavating entire inland seas like the Great Lakes, processing the spoil and redistributing it worldwide. This is why the tower looks the way it does in the diagram. The beams show resonance. The spirals show the cyclone chamber. The arrows show the slurry flood routes. And the plume? That's the global reset, the engineered injection that made sure the mud didn't stay local. And it isn't just the Great Lakes. Look west to California. For more than a century, maps like Nicolas Sanson's La Nueva Mexique in 1657 and Vincenzo Cornelli's 1681 globes show California as a full island separated from the mainland by a wide canal up here at the top. See? Even into the mid-1700s, cartographers like Jacques-Nicolas Baleine in 1744 still drew it that way. But by the 1780s and 1790s, something shifts. Maps like Alexander Dalrymple's English edition, 1790, and the works of Father Kino stop showing California as an island. Instead, it's reattached by redrawing, not by redrawing the whole coast, but by sealing just one narrow strip of land at the head of the Gulf. Think about what that means. Northern California was always part of the mainland. It was only the southern canal that created the island. And when that strip was filled, whether by natural deposition, seismic uplift, or what I believe a slurry deluge event, the canal closed. California didn't really change shape. It was corked. And here's the kicker. That same corridor is exactly where the San Andreas Fault runs today. I wonder why it's so unstable. If California was pulling away from the mainland, plugging that canal with unstable slurry would leave a scar that still grinds and shifts. That instability is what we now call the fault line. People are already starting to say it. The Great Lakes look like quarries. And when you start comparing, it makes too much sense. The Grand Canyon shows dig marks, like a strip mine. Mountains around the world have quarry scars passed off as erosion. The Great Lakes, five perfect basins, side by side, tied into the Mississippi watershed, looks less like glacial accidents and more like industrial scale excavation. But here's the problem. On that scale, no machine we know of today could have done it. You'd need excavators the size of cities. Or, this is what I think, resonance technology. Sonic fields, tools that could soften stone and scoop it like clay. That would explain why some ancient stoneworks look melted, bent, or poured into shape instead of carved. If the world trees really were cut down, trunks miles wide, then the same technology that could fell those would have no problem hollowing out the Great Lakes. These weren't machines like we imagine today with gears and pistons. They were something bigger, stranger, biomechanical titans, plasma-filled excavators, city ships that moved and mined at once. That's the kind of scale we're talking about. All right, we'll move to part two. Hope you have a great night. Namaste.